2 years ago, we were on this stage about a week after Russia invaded Ukraine with the historian and author Anne Applebaum, and the conversation was very different than we had prepared for. This year, we're on the stage about a week after Sora, OpenAI's video project, launched a video, which hopefully we're about to see. So a set of videos were released by Sora. This is not available to the public yet. I hope some of the in the room have seen this. This video was created with a two-sentence prompt and is a preview of what's coming and was the holy fucking shit moment for Hollywood in the last week. Jeffrey Katzenberg said that he expects 90% of animation jobs to go away in the next couple of years in the city. Tyler Perry paused work on an $800 million studio build-out. Is Hollywood dead?
You know, I was thinking about that. If I were Tyler Perry, I would pivot my $800 million investment and double down on building the first AI-native, AI-forward production studio. Because I believe the ones that are going to figure out how to leverage AI to be ahead are going to win. But yes, it is going to be disruptive. I think a lot of jobs may, I don't know if they'll totally go away, but they will morph. But I'm excited because it's going to democratize video production and democratize storytellers and storytelling.
Greg, as a technologist, and you work at Oracle, you're not here speaking on behalf of Oracle, but as a technologist, I mean, for me, from what I'd seen, this is, like, I thought we'd be here in maybe 2 years, year and a half. How does it square with you thought where we'd be?
Well, it's not telling a story, right? It's showing an image. There are people walking down a lane. The human creative element is to tell the story, is to bring out a narrative, right? So it's the possibility here is the fusion of these two things coming together. And we're already doing that now. We're doing it. We just look at the language models. Typically, they're not replacing humans. They're augmenting humans in knowledge worker capacities across all kinds of industries, right? They're making people more productive, making them faster. I think we have the same possibilities here when it comes to video production and studio work, which is, okay, we already did animation, right? Animation hasn't replaced actors. Right? It's taken actors into new roles. It's given them new possibilities. I don't think there's any reason to think that we won't see whole new ways of engaging in the creative process that leverages AI to create parts of the visualization, but still is flowing from the human, creating the meta narrative, creating the structure of the creative process that manifests itself in the video.
Right. But does that mean that Ava DuVernay can create a better prompt than a 17-year-old in Riverside? Or does that mean that really this technology is going to integrate with what we know of the movie making
process? Maybe look at music, bands. You can go on Bandcamp and you can see a billion bands that are creating things in the garage and now they're doing something that looks like professional music production. Mm-hmm. Some of them are quite good. Right? Has it replaced the music industry? Not really. Has it gotten rid of the ability to commercialize music at scale? No. And Taylor Swift's worth billions of dollars. So I think that, you know, we're going to see disruption. There's no question about that. Same way workers were disrupted with the Industrial Revolution, right? And that had all kinds of consequences. And how do people live? How do they make money? Where do they live, right? Well, maybe we'll see similar consequences when it comes to creative studio effects, but I don't think it means it wipes out industries.
Right.
Rana, you and I both have teenagers.
Right.
My teenagers are at two different schools, both of which have banned AI, and that seems crazy to me. They're going to have to learn how to use these tools. How should young people be thinking about these tools and engaging with them, and how should schools be thinking about what policies to put in place?
Yeah, I think it's super important that we allow our, I mean, again, back to this, like, whoever's going to figure out how to use AI is going to be ahead of the game. So I feel strongly that we should, and your boys are probably already experimenting with these AI technologies, as is my son, who's 15.
And my daughter, yep.
Yep, they're already doing that. So doing that in a thoughtful way that's integrated with their everyday experiences is very important. I love this vision of everybody having access to a personal AI assistant. And I think we're headed in that direction. That's going to help you be healthier, more productive, more knowledgeable, more connected. But at the same time, I worry. So for example, there are all these companies right now, like Replica and Character.ai as two specific examples, where you can create an AI friend or an AI companion. And on the one hand, it can help with mental health support, and it's a, you know, somebody that you, or something that could give you access to a lot of information. But we're already seeing these young people spend hours and hours a day engaging with these companions and not with actual friends. And as a mom, I don't know if I'm comfortable if Adam said, you know, I just spent the last 3 hours talking to my AI companion. I think it's a very slippery slope. It's a very, like, we have to be very careful here.
Well, we got it wrong with social media, right?
Right.
I mean, like, the data is super clear. So how do we think about getting this part right? Right, as we evolve from interacting with friends in real life to friends online to now
companion
and like agents, a friend, a buddy, her, whatever it is.
Exactly.
How should we be thinking about what that looks like?
I mean, why can't these companies, you know, have a high bar, right, and not wait for regulation? So, for example, like, it should be the case that if you're engaging with an AI companion or friend, this companion should say, you know what, you've been talking to me for the last 3 hours. I think we, you know, end of conversation. Go do something else. Go out in the real world.
This is Ready Player One, spoiler alert, shutting down the Oasis for a couple days a week to insist on human interaction.
Exactly. But that's not aligned with the company's kind of incentive to maximize engagement, right? And maximize intimacy.
So there's a potential conflict with the business model, at least short term. So Greg, can we count on companies to think about this long term and think about the humanity of it?
I don't think we can count on consumer companies to do the right thing for kids.
History would suggest
that doesn't maybe not seem so to be, you know, and we learned the hard way, right? But we should also reflect on some of those lessons. You know, it was interesting. I was in the East Coast a few weeks ago, and there were placards for a private school that had a cross out through a computer and a cross out through a cell phone. Mm. The idea that you're coming to the school and, hey, we're going to teach you how to learn by actually reading, and you're going to be forced into more kind of rigorous modes of thinking. There's a kind of an appeal to that. On the same token, the world is out there. You can't hide people from it. You can't hide kids from it. I think part of the immediate term responsibility is going to fall to the schools and to the parents, which is, yes, people are going to be exposed to this, but you're going to have to control the exposure.
I mean, good luck with a lot of the parents, right? I mean, again, we saw this with social media, sort of no comprehension of how to set boundaries, how to set limits, what that looks like, notwithstanding Common Sense Media, others doing good work on
it. I like the idea, though, of it not having a tablet with every kid all day in school, mm-hmm. but having a session where it's a structured engagement and you're teaching the kids how to expect to interact with these systems and also where their limitations and where their distortions are, right? And the distortion factor is a huge one because these chatbot kind of interactions have been around since the 70s. I remember little Z80
home-built computers. Yeah, but this is different. I mean, we're talking about near human interaction and what we're experiencing today is literally the worst it will ever be.
Exactly.
It will never be worse than it is today. So
can I give an example from my son's experience? So when ChatGPT first came out, basically a science teacher said, you're allowed to use this, but just basically disclose that you've been using ChatGPT. And so he went online. He was doing a research paper on like trash retrieval and underrepresented communities, whatever. And ChatGPT came up with these like 8 sources, and he couldn't find them. So he came to me, and he was like, Mom, I'm really struggling. Like, these like seem legit, you know, full like sources, but they don't exist. And it was an amazing conversation to talk about how these LLMs work, AI hallucinations, and how to like think through all of that. It was an amazing learning moment. So I think denying our kids that experience is not smart, but having them be AI literate is what we want them to be.
Right. And you know, we were talking backstage and acknowledging that when you do a Google search, you see all the sources, right? You know, am I going to, you know, a more neutral source, something that feels more right, more left, whatever it might be,
right?
And what you're getting out of these LLMs is largely unsourced. And in fact, copyright holders have engineered prompts to replicate their entire copywritten IP, right? So now we've got lawsuits against OpenAI and others dealing with that. So I mean, education can't be the only answer here. Right. Greg, you're acknowledging that companies historically have not done a great job self-regulating. Maybe that's not what we can count on. I worked in Washington. I was chief counsel to United States Senator. I'm well qualified to say how spectacularly unqualified Washington is to regulate this.
Yeah.
So What's the answer here?
Well, the answer may not be entirely one or the other, right? It's not binary. We're going to have collaboration. We're going to have cooperation from a public-private perspective. But one of the things companies should start to look at is how the technology is built in and of itself. The large language models today that most people interact with on the internet, they're just sucking in all this information, copyrighted, non-copyrighted, like this corpus of the internet. And then when you talk to it, what are you getting? You're getting that reflected back through a series of filters or a series of contextual evaluations. There is a technique called retrieval augmented generation that can completely invert that. So in an educational setting, for example, you could have the models always defer to something outside of itself to get the information that's going to use in the response to the prompt. So if you have a school curriculum that's built on Macmillan textbooks, you could set these models up to never look inside themselves, look at the external document corpus from Macmillan and answer questions that are in a curated way.
Okay, great. But Rana, if the textbooks are approved by the state of Texas or approved by the state of California, we're going to get very different answer sets, right? So how should we be thinking about that?
I think it's very hard to completely get rid of bias, but a lot of these models have unintentional bias built in them. And that, I think that's where the big problem is, and we have to be very intentional and thoughtful about both data and algorithmic bias. A lot of it comes back to like literacy, like understanding how these models work and the importance of the data and all of that. But at the end of the day, I'm a huge advocate for thoughtful regulation. I think we need to keep pushing for that. But I agree with you, we can't wait for regulation.
Like, okay.
So as leaders, we need to lead the way, like all of us in this room. Like, we're innovating in this space. We're at the forefront of inventing these technologies, deploying these technologies. We should be thinking about the unintended consequences ahead of time.
So we saw just this week with Google's Gemini, this is not to pick on Google because everyone's got these biases built into these problems, but prompts for images of Nazi soldiers that return black soldiers, a prompt for images of popes that returned female popes, which offensive to many Catholics and also kind of transgressive and like interesting, but like clearly reflecting biases that are built into the tech. So if the ghosts of human bias are going to be latent in the machines already, they're built in, are we already kind of behind? Have we already lost?
Yeah, we forget that these models are built by humans, right? And so they, you kind of build these biases into, it's a reflection of society and it's a reflection of whoever's building these models. So we're seeing that.
What do we do to fix that? I mean, is there a way to address that or is the game already up here, Greg?
Well, I think everybody wants viewpoint neutrality. Like that is sort of the standard that people are expecting. And then when they encounter the models, they find out, oh, well, that's not what actually happens. In the case of Google, you know, all the instruction tuning and so forth was clearly militating toward a certain progression of creative development for the images that maybe reflected what people in Google like, but didn't play well out in the broader world. One solution may simply be that we need more than just a Google providing these kind of services. Right? Maybe, you know, there may be companies that have a very different orientation and people can choose to use which models and which services reflect their own values. Because I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with creating some of the controversial images. It's what artists do, right? If you go into any contemporary art exhibit today, transgression almost over defines.
Sure, but if the prompt specifically asks for that, right, that's one thing. If the prompt is asking for something historical and it is returning something ahistorical.
I think it's a poor choice. Okay. But I'm just saying maybe we need more systems that are reflected in trying to give historical accuracy, right? And then you know who's trusted or at least better capable of doing that.
I also think more transparency around how these models are, we have no idea what data is going into the training of these models. So a little bit more transparency on the model training, but also on how these models are validated or tested or challenged, I think would be very important for consumers. And ultimately, consumers can also vote with their feet by deciding which models to use and adopt.
Sure. And one of the challenges is to be a real player in AI, you need, a gazillion dollars. You need massive computing power, right? It's very hard for a startup seeing that Sora video to say, oh, we're gonna go after yeah. this category, given the time, money, and literally the energy that it takes to train. So is there a way to level the playing field a little bit and make sure that smaller players that maybe have more ethical business models are getting a chance to surface?
So I do a lot of investing in the AI space, and I feel very passionately about this. I think we need to support. There's going to be a need for new architectures that run on the edge with smaller, more focused data, like you were talking about. And so that's one piece of it, finding these new innovators that are building these like next generation models and architectures. But at the same time, if we're investors, we need to hold a higher bar of the founders. Like, do they think about ethics? Do they think about the moral obligations of these technologies? Like, at the end of the day, like, more diverse minds and brains around the table will help us deal with bias, because you'll have different from people with different perspectives. So, but most of the time, these founding teams don't think about that at all. They don't have diversity of thought and diversity of perspective as a priority. So I feel like, for all the investors in the room, it's a responsibility we have.
One of the things that I'm spending a lot of time thinking about, and I'm generally an AI optimist. We wouldn't be here having this conversation otherwise, notwithstanding the challenges that we're talking about. But seeing this and having seen the AI voice clone robocalls in New Hampshire in the primary season, you know, I'm already worried about a free and fair election and what is going to be influencing voter behavior. And I'm especially worried about the bad actors out there, right? Those who have an interest in undermining American democracy, largely abroad, but also, you know, within mm-hmm. our borders.
Yeah.
If YouTube or TikTok or Meta called each of you and said, what should we be doing? How should we be thinking about protecting against deepfakes that are going to potentially swing an election? What would you be saying to them?
Transparency. The number one problem I see right now is we really have no deep understanding of what's happening inside these systems. And of course, when they react and they put in their own internal regulations and they're not transparent against, everybody screams bias in one direction or another, right? Like, oh, the Twitter is throwing the election to the Republicans. It's throwing the election to the Democrats. Well, maybe, or maybe they're struggling to put controls in place and we really need to understand what the controls are.
Doesn't right? that transparency actually let the bad actors know how to beat the system more easily?
It lets the public know how these systems are going to operate. I think the bad actors are going to be experimenting with how they can break the system no matter what. I don't know how much of an edge that really gives them. They've got sophisticated people playing on the boundaries of what technology breaches they can find. They're going to find the breaches no matter what. Right now, the number one problem I see is that no one really knows what's happening inside these systems, and nobody really trusts that these are neutral actors in the political process in particular. And that causes just a whole wave of toxic effects downstream. So I would say transparency up front now. Here's what we see. Here's what we're going to do. So all the cards are on the table and people can at least understand what this set of decisions means in terms of implications for how our social or political systems play out.
All right, Ryan, I'm going to ask you to yes and that.
Yeah,
what's
exactly.
the and on that?
I saw Sora, I saw an article mentioned that basically Sora will try to watermark or at least disclose if a video is generated using their technology, so it's AI-generated video. I think the solution, I mean, one way to think about it is a human in the loop, but that's not scalable, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's not going to scale. So it has to be an algorithmic solution, and we just, as a country, we're going to have to, as a nation, we're going to have to be two steps ahead algorithmically in terms of what these models can do. And
well, again, how transparent are the social media companies about what they can or can't detect? Like,
right.
I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Right? But we know it's an arms race, right?
Right.
So staying two steps ahead might be impossible. We might be best hoping for being half a step ahead. Behind, yeah. Right?
Right?
I mean, and this is going to take investments not of millions or tens of millions. It's going to be hundreds of millions, probably yeah. billions of dollars to stay there. Is that consistent with their business model? Or are they going to laugh when you say, this is my advice, is spend whatever it takes to make sure that we're no worse than a half beat behind?
I actually think it's going to spur a whole new economy. Like as we think about, for example, the virtual human economy, right? Like where you can now generate digital twins and likeness for all of us. Well, I think there's going to be new companies that are going to be in the business of licensing, these AI generated content and characters, and we're going to see new business models. So I think it's going to spur an economy, but I don't know if it's going to happen in time for election. I'm worried.
Okay.
Because once this content is out, it's really hard to undo it in somebody like my mom's brain, right?
So is this actually a call to arms for the platforms from both of you, saying you've got to invest whatever you need to invest to protect the public and protect our democracy right now?
Well, I don't run a social media company, so it's
hard
for me to say what the
advice.
Decision matrix should
yeah.
be. But if I were to look at it as a citizen, as a user of social media, as a parent, you know, their brand is dependent on showing responsibility in the context of a technology revolution that's playing out in lifetime. So if I were trying to manage the brand, I would be very concerned about this as much as I would be about consumer growth of consumer count and hits and interaction with the platform. I would say this would be my number one concern, especially this year, given that it is a major election year.
Rana?
Yeah, I would agree. 100% agree with that.
Okay. 23 minutes is not a lot of time to discuss everything happening in the world of AI. Before we wrap, Rana, you've just left your job. You were founder, CEO of Affectiva, which was acquired, you sold, and you're off. You referenced making some investments in the AI space. What's coming next for you?
So a couple of things. One of them is I'm raising a fund to invest in AI native companies that are at the intersection of AI, health and well-being, including mental health, climate protection, and sustainable food systems. So, and I know there's many people probably in the audience that are interested in this too. So I'd love to reach out. I'd love to collaborate and partner. And then the other one.
Because you don't have enough going on is Wait What is the home of Reid Hoffman's Masters of Scale. This panel is somewhat cheekily called Masters of AI because good luck on that. But you're also going to be hosting a new show called Pioneers of AI, joining the Masters of Scale family. Yeah. And we're excited to have you.
Excited
and
to
thank you all for your time today.
Thank you.